All right. Hi, everybody. My name is Helena. I'm from New York City. My sobriety date is June 10th, 1992. Been here for a couple of minutes. It wasn't my first date. My first date was June 8th, 1985. But I'll tell you more about that later, if you choose to hang around and listen. Because Megan told me I got to speak for 55 minutes, so I'm frightened, but that's not going to happen. And then she also told me that I should tell my story and not be a douchebag. So I'm not going to be a douchebag tonight. I've never been a douchebag, and I don't want that to be part of my story tonight. So, I am Helena, like I said. I'm an addict, I'm an alcoholic. Also called dependent, and also very nervous. I know most of you here tonight, so that makes me feel a tad bit comfortable, but not quite, because I'm on the hot seat. I never like speaking. And matter of fact, let me turn on the video. I never like speaking, and I like it even less if I'm recorded. I remember one time Mark had asked me to speak, and I was recorded. And the whole time that I spoke, I just kept saying, oh, come on in. It was crazy. But when somebody asks me to speak, I try my best to say yes. But I can say no. I can't say no because it's not like I don't do service, all across the board. I believe in service. Service keeps me sober. And I like to give back freely what was so freely given to me when I first came in the rooms. The last millennium. So I'm here. I don't exactly know where to start, so I'll start kind of like the earlier days and move on up. I gotta fill that space because if I don't, Megan gonna get me. So gotta do it. I'm from New York. I was born in New York. I have lived other places in my life, but New York is where I'm at right now. Right now, I'm in Carp City in the Bronx, and I've been in this apartment for 28 years. Imagine that. I never thought I'd be here this long. I never thought I would be in the rooms this long, Never, never, never. And I never wanted to be in the rooms this long. I'll tell you that when I first got here, I'm like, I'm only staying 6 months. That's it. I was born in the Bronx, but I lived in Brooklyn the earliest part of my life. I lived with my mother. My mother and my father were divorced early on. And my mother was a very beautiful, talented young woman. And the friends she hung around with, like on the weekends and this and that, were all autistic people like herself. So I was introduced early to music, to art, playing cards, watching, listening, smelling weed, but I didn't know what the weed was. I didn't know that till later. All this stuff. But so I watched them and I learned a lot. And everybody there had something to teach me. One of my friends bought me a Roget's Thesaurus. I was 5 years old. So I learned how to read by the time I got to kindergarten. I knew how to draw. I knew how to dance, I knew how to sing. Very talented young person. And I don't know. Once I got into school, it wasn't the greatest, because I was the teacher's pet, because I was always the smallest in school. I was any class I was in, I always knew the answers and this and that, because I studied and I read a lot. I still do. I read a book a week. So I had a hard time. Had a hard time with a little boy in the class. He used to pick at me. And one day I decided I'd just stick my pencil in his ear and he won't bother me no more. And and I got into a lot of trouble with that. So then it was discovered that there was something a tad bit wrong with me. I started to be, I don't know, like very violent. And not that I picked on people, but I guess I set up like this invisible boundary that only I could see, but other people saw it because I didn't have any trouble on it, any bullying or anything like that going forward. So I did well, you know, in school, did well, keep going well as the years went by. There was a situation where I was molested by one of my mother's friend's neighbor's son. And I mentioned that, and nothing wasn't done about it. I heard a lot of arguing, a lot of screaming, but that told me that if anybody was going to take care of Helena, it had to be me. I got to see my father every now and then, but not much. He lived in New Jersey at the time, and he would pick me up, take me to the diner, take me to these places and this and that. I used to ask him to teach me how to do stuff like skating, ride a bike, and this and that, but nobody to teach me anything. You know, anything I had to learn as far as athletics or anything, handball, all that, I had to go to other people. My mother, she was busy with what she was doing with work and this and that. And I don't know, that kind of told me that anything that I needed to do, I needed to find somebody and they would help me. You know, the first time I ever smoked a cigarette, I was 6 years old, and I didn't even cough. That should have been a header right there. Whenever you smoking like that, and they were camels. They were camels, you know, camels, they had these cigarettes unfiltered, you know, and I'm smoking like I was born smoking, you know. And I also was a little thief. I turned into a thief very early. What I would do is I would take money out of my mother's pocketbook and go buy my friends ice cream because I wanted friends, you know, but it was hard to make friends when you're the teacher's pet all the time, you know. And but it's okay. I did the best I could with what I had. And, you know, my mother would ask me questions about how I felt or what this and that and this and that. But I would always tell her, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Because I don't know felt like the safest answer. I don't know. I don't know. And, you know, time went by. I started to get into trouble as I got into my teenage years, wound up in a gang. And it was decided since I wasn't showing up at school, because I would just go to school, take the tests, the exams, or whatever, pass them, and then go out and smoke weed or alcohol. So I had, by that time, graduated to that. And yeah, so it was decided that I would be sent to a school, a boarding school, down south in North Carolina. And I did that for 2 years. I got to come home on spring break, but when I came home on spring break, I'd come home, put my suitcase up or whatever, go hang out in the street. That school that I was sent to is no longer around now. Matter of fact, it's in decay. But it was one of the first schools for all people of color. And this was back in the 60s in the South. So you might know that that might have been, I don't know, my mother was like really brave to send me down there because North Carolina was kind of jumping with a lot of stuff with segregation and civil rights and all this kind of stuff. But we didn't have any trouble at that school, but I made my own trouble. I discovered corn liquor. Down there, they'd have it in these big mason jars, and I would drink that, but I didn't like it. But I found best for me was to sniff Carbona, the cleaning fluid, and put it on a handkerchief and just sniff it. And I'd be in class, I'd be like, oh, because you could smell it. I mean, you could really smell it, you know. But I still managed to pass because I was smart. You know, I was very, very smart, and I did okay. But I did end up getting suspended from that school, and I committed, well, I tried to commit suicide there. And so I was kicked out of the school. And I can remember the principal telling my mother when she came to pick me up to take me back to New York that that I needed psychiatric help. My mother was like, we already looked at that. You know, she's fine. She's fine. But you know what? I wasn't fine. I wasn't fine, you know. But what can we do? So got back to New York and I got into all kind of trouble. By that time, I had started to pick up heroin, which has always been my love and my drug of choice. Always, hands down, it will always be heroin. Till the day I die, I just can't use it. You know, I fell in love with with heroin. I met a young man, and he became the father of my child. He was also a heroin dealer, but he was the team basketball player at school. The best clothes, and he was one of the handsomest men I ever seen. He was a handsome young man. You know, I've always been attracted to handsome young men, and well, handsome older ones too ain't bad, you know. But yeah, so that has always been part of my story, you know. So anyway, I ended up having a child. By this time, I had turned 18. I had had a child. Robert, that's his name. He got busted and he got sent away to a detox program and a program up in Daytop Village, upstate New York. So I was kind of the offended, like kind of like for myself. I got a job that didn't work out well because I just I just had a thing about like taking orders. I could do the job. Just leave me alone. Let me do the fucking job. Just give me, you know, the diagram, whatever, and this and that. I told you I was smart. I could do it. So all I had to do was show up. But when you pay me now, make sure you pay me at the end of the day. Don't pay me at lunchtime. Because if I get paid at lunchtime, I go cash the check. I'm not coming back. Because I'm going to get high. Always. That's always been part of my story. You know, no matter what job I had until I came to the room. And I didn't have many. Because, you know, once I got into the heroin game, you know, I had to find me some fellas to learn me how to work the streets, how to make money, how to work credit cards, how to forge checks, how to do all this stuff. So I turned into that kind of hustler. And I got into a lot of trouble, a little jail here and there, but I had to do what I had to do. I told myself, okay, well, you got this job, you're a dope fiend now. You can admit you're a dope fiend. It took me a year before I realized that I had a problem. Like I needed it. I needed it. I thought I was still to the stage where I just wanted it. But no, I needed it, you know. But I got high every day. So how could I even know that I had a habit? Because I just topped it off every day. I get some heroin. I get some hash if I could find it. Get a little something to drink, because after the hash, then your mouth is dry, you need something to drink, you know. So it was just this whole cycle. It was so crazy, you know, but that's part of my journey, you know. So it just got harder and harder and harder and harder. You know, I would get together with a couple of men here and there. A couple of men told me, oh, we're gonna try to pimp you out, this and that. That wasn't working with me. And plus, I forgot to mention that I did learn a little martial arts. So I never had any problem with men going upside my head, you know. But anyway, so going forward, you know, I told myself to make myself feel better that, well, at least you're not selling your ass in the street. At least you're not doing that. All these at least, you know, those are yets. Those were yets for me, you know. And it just got harder and harder and harder. And I was just getting older and older and older. And, you know, I wasn't the best mother. Matter of fact, I was a shitty mother. I could say that. You know, if I could leave my mother with a family member, that was fine. You know, I didn't want my daughter to see me doing certain things, you know. But my daughter, no matter what, my daughter always loved me. You know, so, oh, mommy, it's okay. Mommy, we're going to do this. We're going to do that, you know. So finally, I had had a couple of more suicide attempts. And the last one, which I really hope is the last one, a day at a time, I wound up in the psych ward in Harlem Hospital. By this time, I was in my 30s by then. Oh, and I forgot to mention, I got married to one man twice, the same man twice. So you knew I was a little bit off. But anyway. So anyway, he was in jail by then. And I was once again on my own hustling in the street, but I made a lot of money. I need to say that. I made a lot of money, a lot more than I made in sobriety. I can tell you that, but that's okay. That's okay, because look where I was going, you know. So I wound up in the psych ward. I had that last suicide attempt. When they found me, I had almost bit off my tongue and my heart had stopped twice. They took me to the psych ward. I stayed there for 10 months. 10 months, that's a long damn time. But I did hear somebody in a meeting today when I went to a meeting earlier, and they said they had been in the ward for 14 months. I'm like, wow, somebody was actually there as long as me. Because I never heard nobody else say they had been there that long, you know. And in my mind, being in the psych ward that long, it wasn't so bad, you know. Every now and then somebody would bring some weed in. I smoked some weed, you know. I'd play cards all day long, writing my journal and this and that. I did get into one fight with a girl there. I beat this girl up and they end up putting me in the straitjacket because she stole my cigarettes. The first time I let her get away with it, the second time it wasn't happening. Nowadays they don't tie you up and put you in the straitjacket. I'm laughing about it now because it's like funny. I went through it, but that shit was serious as hell. I'm like, well, she stole my shit, you know, and they gave me a shot. And it was a terrible, terrible experience. They did give me some medicine. And the medicine I was allergic to, and all my hair started falling out. My tongue, I couldn't keep it in my mouth, and my head was going all like this. But yet, this is a place that I wanted to stay. You know, so I just needed a break from the street. It was what I was thinking, you know. So, but anyway, after the 10 months, it was suggested that maybe I go and get into like a drug program because it wasn't so much the medication with the depression. They felt like my main problem was drugs and alcohol, you know. So little they know it all meshed together. I know that now, you know. So I did go away to this program, and when I got to this program, and I had been in a program previously back in the 70s, but the only reason I was there is because somebody told me the feds were after me. So I figured I would run and go in this program. And they never found me. But you know what? Listen, it's not like I'm Dillinger or anything. If they wanted me, they could have got me anytime, you know. So, but yeah, I had been in a program for a short time before. But this program that I went to after the psych ward, you know, it was a good program. It wasn't like very stringent like some programs where you had to be assigned or you had to sit around, you know, in a group and they tell you, oh, this and that, and shout and scream at you. It wasn't like that. You know, this program offered you, if you wanted, you know, educational stuff, they would help you with that. Or they also had meetings coming. This is when I first found out about AA and NA. I had seen stuff like, you know, in the movies and TV about AA and NA, not too much, a little bit, but I still didn't think that was my problem. I still harbored the thought that my main problem was I was in the psych ward, so I must be, you know, off, really off the beam. And plus, people had told me that since I was a little kid, so you know, that's what I was running with. But I started to go to the in-house meeting, and they had NA and they had AA. So we would have like four meetings a week, and people would come in, you know, from the street into our meeting house. And lo and behold, I got to see some people I was actually using with. So it was attraction for me because they looked like really good. You know, some of them were touters in the street. If you don't know what a touter is somebody that will direct you to the worst dope in the world just so they can get paid after you go buy it. So some of them were touters, and I wasn't trying to look at them, but when I seen them, their skin was bright, their eyes were bright. Some of them even had on a little gold, some of them had cars. I'm like, oh shit, look at them. So then, you know, I told myself, well, listen. If they could do it, I know I could do it, you know. So I had that kind of attitude, you know. But I said, yeah, but I only want to do this shit for 6 months. You know, I don't want to not get high for the rest of my life. I wasn't looking at the day at the time because I had no concept of program. I didn't know about program. I hadn't been to outside meetings. I hadn't studied any of the books or got a sponsor or any of that, you know. But so that was a key for me, you know. I did get a stipend job. with the program, and so they would give you this little funky check every 2 weeks, you know. And I was like, okay. I did have some money in the bank though, but I didn't tell them that. But I did have something. But what happened was one day I was coming home or back to the program. I had just got this funky check that I just got finished telling you about, and I was like, well, damn, I feel like getting high. It just came on me out of the blue. It was like, and I guess, you know, they say money is a mood changer. If you don't have none, it'll change your mood. And if you have some, it'll change your mood too, you know, especially if somebody's trying to take it from you. Ugh. But anyway, so I got that feeling. But then again, another thought popped into my head, and I know it was only because of the meetings I went to. Okay. You got a choice. You can go to a meeting right now and see what you can hear that'll keep you from picking up the next one. That was the turning point for me right there. Right there. So I went to the meeting and I didn't use. So I stood that way for almost 7 years, you know, and then one day I did pick up. But I picked up for 2 days. So matter of fact, the day that I picked up was the day that Mark C came into the world. Yeah. But the day he was born was the day that I picked up a drug. You know, I always tease him. I say, yep, you came into the world just so you could tell me, listen, you got to keep going. Yeah, so that's a little private joke in between him and I. But yeah, so I had the 2 day relapse. But, you know, I'm glad that even though I had the relapse, I learned that I came right back. I had to go to psych ward just for those 2 days. I needed to go away. Not to a long-term program, just did a program for a couple of weeks, and then I came back out, and I've been clean ever since. I need to tell you, it's been rough areas, but I wouldn't trade what I went through or where I'm at now for anything, because I never thought I would live this long. You know, in 1992, I was diagnosed with, 1989, I was diagnosed HIV positive. So, you know, I had to go through that. I had to learn about how to take care of myself, how to protect myself, how to protect others if I was dealing with somebody. I had to learn a whole new way. And I think that, you know, when that happened, that was a good thing. I try to look at it as a good thing because I learned how to cherish more the time I had on this earth, especially since they told me I only had a year to live, you know? So, you know, and even when I got the diagnosis, I was shocked, but not surprised. I don't know if that makes sense, but not surprised because I knew my background, you know. So, and I didn't mention I use heroin intravenously, so I neglected to tell you that. So that kind of led up to that, and it could have been me catching it sexually because I was super promiscuous because I always hung around with the guys, so I always had like a man's attitude towards sex, but not so much so that I was going to get out there and sell my ass. That wasn't happening. But yeah, I told you I like handsome men. That should have been a clue for you all right there. So anyway, so it was hard. I had to learn how to eat differently. I had to learn to exercise. I went into Tai Chi, and that's when I started my journey with meditation. You know, I started with meditation then. I started being educated about a person living with HIV, especially a woman. It was hard back then. I seen a lot of people die, a lot. You know, even before I got into recovery, I was seeing that, you know. And I was afraid, but I showed up for myself. You know, I said, well, I only got a year to live. I might as well make, you know, the best of it. So I got, you know, that education base. And I was like, damn, I wanted to go to college, you know, because I did have a job previously back in the 80s. I was working in this college, this registrar's office. And what I would do is I would help some of the the students that would come in with their term papers. I was a very good writer. I still am, by the way. And I would help them, and they would pay me. You know, they would pay me. So between that and a little job I had as I'll call it light stripping at Showgirls on 42nd Street. I had a little thing going there, but yeah. So all those things were forbidden to me, and I wanted to go to college the right way, you know. And I did, but it took me 8 years to do it. Because I kept saying, oh no, I'm gonna die this year. Even today, sometimes I you know, I lay down, I'm like, will this be the last day? You know, so then I say, well, okay, if it is, just, you made the best of it. It was a good day, you know. So each day is like a gift to me, you know, because I never know when it's going to be no more. And I'm 72 now, and I started this journey when I was in my 30s, you know. So I don't know. But anyway, I did go to college. I went to undergrad school, College of New Rochelle. I got my bachelor's. I came out with honors, of course. I told you I was smart. But anyway, I came out with honors. I did very well. Then I went to grad school, got my master's in social work. But by then, I was tired. I'm like, oh, I'm so tired of school. Yeah, because I'm older, so I had to, like, work harder. You know, the papers, the this, the that. You know, it was very hard. But I did it. I did it, and I worked a full-time job at the same time. You know, some days I was very tired. Some days I couldn't make it home. I'd go to one of my cousin's house that lived further downtown in the lower Bronx, and I'd spend the night because I couldn't make it home. I was too tired. And I had a late night class at 9 o'clock at night, and I had to get up and go to work 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, I can't make it, you know. So, but anyway, I got through it. So yeah, so that's what my life has been about. So I worked for a while. I've worked in hospitals as a social worker. I worked with homeless women, and they gave me the blues. That is a rough population. Oh, some of them were coming out of jail. They'd be like, good morning, bitch. Oh, God. I wanted to smack all of them, but that was the job, you know. But yes, I stood there until I couldn't work there anymore. I got sick at work. Came down with shingles, and I got very ill. So I had to come out and I retired after a while. I came out on disability, and then the depression started to set in again. So I sought therapy, and it's been a hard road. I'm retired now for a while, now over 10 years. It'll be 11 years in September. So I told myself, when this pandemic period came up, I said, well, you know, if I got through the AIDS epidemic, I could certainly get through this shit. But I had no idea that the pandemic was going to be this long. You know, I don't know what I thought, but I told myself at the beginning of the pandemic, if I get sick, you know, and I have to wind up in the hospital, I'm going to kill myself because I can't do it. I can't do it. And that's a reservation, by the way. But I did talk to people about it, you know. I don't want to be in a position where I can't take care of myself. You know, I don't want to be in a nursing home. I don't want to be any of those things. But I do talk about it because it may come to that. You know, I'm older now, and I'm starting to, like, not remember a lot of things. I'm having a lot of problems with, like, my shoulder. Then it was, like, the neuropathy, probably from all the antivirals that I've been taking for the HIV over the years, you know, that builds up in your system. It may help with the HIV, but it damages other parts of your body. That shit is strong as hell. But anyway, it's kept me alive this long. So far, I'm doing okay. I haven't come down with COVID yet this whole period. So I've been pretty lucky with that. And I just show up, you know, I make meetings. I do a lot of service. I stay connected. I did get to go on a cruise this summer. My daughter, who I was telling you about, is now grandmother. So I'm a great grandmother. I haven't seen my great granddaughter yet. I've only seen her on Zoom. You know, she came into the world, and she's had COVID twice already. You know, my whole family that live in Arkansas now, they don't believe in the vaccine. You know, and I can't be around them. I can't expose myself to them because they're always getting sick. This thing and that thing. I'm like, oh hell no. I'll see you on Zoom. But I would like to see my great granddaughter before I leave the planet, you know. But I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know what the days will bring a day at a time. But I am ever grateful that I'm in the process of wanting to live. Staying sober, enjoying myself. Been on a cruise this summer. That was a little scary at first, but I fell right in with the program. I had a ball. I'm looking to see where I want to go this summer. I told Zanna and Marsha, I want to come to Canada, you know, because I know they'll show me a good time and I love them dearly. So we'll see. We'll see what happens a day at a time. I am a little concerned about this shoulder shit, though, because I need my shoulder. I can't draw. I can't do anything. But I can lift it, but I got x-rays, and they told me, they said, well, it's a little arthritis, but it's been bothering me. And also, I take acupuncture. I didn't tell you that. Yeah. I try to address every area. I even got my teeth fixed not long ago. See? Yeah, and I told myself I would never go to the dentist again. I hate the dentist. I hate it. So I try to address everything that's going on in my body to its optimum best, the best I can. I mean, I got to work with what I got, you know? So that's where I'm at. I have to go for an x-ray. In 2 weeks, I have to go for an x-ray. So then they'll let me know. If maybe it's a rotator cuff thing going on. I don't know. But they did scare me. They said if it's a rotator cuff, we might have to cut it. Then you have to wear a sling for 6 weeks. I'm like, what? I'm like, no, we can do something else. You know, I didn't tell you I broke my hand once and I was on crutches once as well. So I'm afraid of slings and crutches and all this and all of that. I don't want to do it. But we'll see. Because all of that, you know, they tell me these things. And then my mind goes into catastrophic thinking, you know? So I'm just trying to stay in it now where I'm at today. So for today, I'm okay. I'm not as nervous now. I'm glad you all are here. I'm glad you chose to listen to me this evening. I hope I helped someone. If not, I certainly helped me by showing up and not punking out and say, oh, I can't make it. But I wouldn't do that to Megan. Megan would kick my ass. So, but anyway. Thank you all for being here, and thank you for listening to me, and I hope you have a splendid-licious and a sobalicious evening. Bye for now.